our town now. Three town bypasses revisited. Goulburn, Armidale and Karooa. This oral history project is based on original interviews conducted by Rhonda McGregor with RTA staff who were involved in the planning and construction of the bypasses of Goulburn, Armidale and Karooa, and with members of the local communities. It describes the traffic conditions in the towns prior to their being bypassed, the way the bypass projects were planned and designed in consultation with the local communities, the ways the communities were kept informed and involved, and how the towns have changed since the bypasses were opened. The oral history was commissioned by the RTA Environment Branch in 2007. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.
Good afternoon and welcome to what is a celebration, and in my mind, a celebration of freedom of Goulburn. When the bypass opened 10 years ago on the 5th of December 1992, we basically freed up our city and we got it back.
It might be hard to imagine the difference a road can make to a town, but on the 10th anniversary of the opening of the Goulburn bypass, the town was celebrating.
Just remember when, if you stood in Auburn Street, as Graham has said, you just couldn't hear yourself speak. You risked your life crossing the street because of the trucks lumbering through. And today, if we see a semi-trailer, we say, that poor driver must be lost. He obviously doesn't know his way around here.
And there was no disagreement from people in the audience.
Well, I think the bypass has been good for Goulburn. Certainly the number of semi-trailers and things like that that it removes from the main street makes it safer and a lot friendlier, a lot easier to shop.
It's so much quieter here, you know, in town. I think it's lovely.
Best thing that's ever happened at Goulburn. Less fumes, noise, hold-ups.
Well, it's brought more tourists into the place now.
I see the houses are all going up in price and that, you know, so...
So what was Goulburn like before the bypass? Katrina Hodgkinson, member for Burrinjuck in the New South Wales Parliament.
At one stage I think we had something like 15,000 semi-trailers going down the Hume Highway. I mean, at one stage in Auburn Street, the whole street would just be full of semi-trailers, both ways. And trying to get across the road to get your lunch, you'd really take your life into your own hands.
The semi-trailers also caused problems for local businesswoman Angela Storia.
We've got a business in the main street, Superline Auto Spares, and the daily task of wiping down all the stock, which you get a fine film of diesel on it, over the fittings, over the building itself, of not being able to stand on the footpath and talk with somebody, because you simply couldn't hear each other speak.
New England highway traffic made its way through the main streets of Armidale. David Hegarty was the city engineer.
It was an appropriate route in the Model T days or the horse and sulky days, but with traffic volumes and the growth of Armidale, it was a totally inappropriate route. And there was a problem every afternoon.
Armidale's Deputy Lord Mayor at the time was Richard Torbay.
I think it was 800 trucks from memory a day going through Armidale, and I remember one resident took me to their house on the old highway and I spent most of a night there, and the noise, it was very significant. The gears shifting and the big sort of brake noises and things that were going on, they were clearly an issue affecting the quality of life of those people. And safety, health, noise, you know, they're the sorts of things that came up.
The Lord Mayor was Joe Harold.
We'd get hundreds and hundreds of trucks going through almost our CBD on a daily basis. I remember the Armidale Express, the local newspaper, actually having a photograph going down the main street where I think you could count something like 12 trucks all within that sort of time frame of that photograph being taken. And that was a regular occurrence for us.
Traffic numbers in Karooa were even higher. Traffic planning manager at Port Stephens Council, Phil Buchan.
I think the annual daily vehicle trips through town was something in the order of between 10 and 12,000 vehicles a day. In the peak holiday periods, that was well over the 25 to 30,000 vehicles in the peak days of Christmas and Easter.
Trying to manage this volume of traffic was a lost cause. RTA project manager on the Karooa Bypass, Dick Whibley.
What's often forgotten is that Karooa was a bottleneck, the bottleneck on the Pacific Highway. The way we forced vehicles through the town during those high traffic days was, in fact, to erect a fence right through the middle of town to stop people doing U-turns, to stop people crossing the highway, and to stop people from slowing down, to force them through rather than slowing down. And no matter what we did, there was always huge queues at Karooa.
Getting onto Karooa's main street was a challenge for local residents. President of the Karooa Progress Association, Fred McInerney.
To drive into the business area, the main street, you had to basically plan it. Now, if I wanted to park on this side of the street, I went around the back street and come around the corner, because now the highway traffic was there and it was busy and it was easier to do things like that.
To improve traffic flow and relieve towns of congestion, noise and pollution, the highway upgrade program has sometimes meant the bypassing of towns. The decision to do this is made by the government of the day. RTA project manager on the Karooa Bypass, Graham Kinnear.
The government of the day can actually mean two things. It can mean the state government, or in the case of main highways, it can mean the federal government also. New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority, that's the RTA, is managing the program with a view to achieving a balance between social needs, the ecological needs of the undisturbed countryside, between engineering and cost factors. And we really are out to save lives and provide broadly better travelling conditions. When it comes to social and community benefits, we feel that the community is benefiting from highway upgrades because we have safer and better travelling conditions. We reduce travel times and vehicle operating costs. We're separating highway and local traffic. We're providing a lot more rest areas and parking bays. And we're improving infrastructure, which in turn supports regional development. When a freeway or a major road is developed, the surrounding areas all of a sudden spring to life, and so it is a starter to other development. It provides extra employment opportunities. Often it's an opportunity to boost tourism, and often, with the removal of traffic, it gets the town back to what it should be and provides better in-town lifestyle and better amenity for the people that live there.
Highway upgrades begin with a series of investigations to determine route options, site constraints, and project costs. It's a process that can take years and results in the environmental impact statement. Graham Kinnear.
In the EIS process, we study the general area, we identify all of the route options, we study the route sufficiently to know in detail what the differences are and can cost those differences. We whittle the list down, that's the list of options, and identify a preferred option and announce it and say, okay, we're really going to study this particular preferred route to death. So we absolutely know it inside out. And we then carry an in-depth study of the preferred route with a lot of local input.
Wanting to contribute to their EIS process, the Goulburn Chamber of Commerce and Industry asked consultant Ken McNally to survey business leaders about the proposed bypass.
The survey was essentially about what route should be taken, what would be the likely effects of the bypass, and what the community should be doing to prepare for the bypass. In terms of the route, the community was very concerned that a bypass route removing the view of Goulburn would result in the loss of a significant amount of passing trade. And so it wasn't all that unexpected to find that the business leader's option was for the route that was closest to Goulburn and most likely to give the view.
There was a lack of precedent to guide Goulburn as to what to expect, and the concern was that they would wake up one day and find there was no traffic and no business. Ken McNally.
Goulburn is on the main route to Melbourne, to Canberra and to the snow. And the main concern was, because the city would no longer be viewable, then some special things had to be done to attract people into the community. The city access should be landscaped. It should be attractive for people to drive in. Signposting was considered to be important, obviously. Having a mall on the main street was considered to be a good idea. Fostering major sporting events was considered to be a good idea. And promoting Goulburn's heritage was considered to be a good idea. And so they were the main issues that people wanted to get behind at the time.
Armidale schoolboy Matthew Ferris also conducted a survey as part of a Year 11 school project.
I wasn't particularly interested in the engineering side of it. I was more interested in the impact it would have on residents and businesses of Armidale. So I went about interviewing people like stakeholders in the highway, I guess you'd call them now, motel owners, service station owners, fast food outlets, things like that. I basically asked them how much they thought their business relied on highway traffic, and of that, how much did they think they would lose as a result of the bypass, and then from that, how do they think they would recover, or how would they generate further business? A couple of the service station owners thought that having service stations either side of the start and finish of the bypass would be a good idea. Some hoteliers expressed interest about relocating to the outskirts of town. A lot of other businesses thought it was a great idea because it got rid of heavy traffic, heavy vehicles, and they thought the impact of heavy vehicles had a negative impact on traffic and the amenity of Armidale itself, and they were quite supportive of the thing.
Joe Harold's recollection is that two sectors of the Armidale business community were especially concerned at the prospect of a bypass.
The local petrol people were particularly frightened about what this would mean. They were talking about having to close down. They were talking about laying off apprentices. They were pulling on all the heartstrings. And then, of course, all of the moteliers. They were concerned too around missing out on that passing traffic, and those people who got there and said, oh, we'll stop here for the night, I wouldn't be doing that, they'd be on the bypass.
Norm Medhurst, chairman of Armidale City Council's Traffic Committee, has similar memories.
A lot of business was against it, and like the moteliers and the restaurants and the small shops reckoned that they would lose a lot of business by it.
With the community making representations to him about the polarised issues of quality of life and impacts on business, Richard Torbay went in search of information.
I like to work on facts, particularly when there's an emotive part where people could potentially feel as if they're going to lose their business. Equally as emotive was the people that were suffering asthma and noise complaints and couldn't sleep, you know. And my sympathies were with the residents, I have to say, in listening to the merits. Mainly because I couldn't substantiate this so-called devastation that was going to occur in the business sector. When I'd ask for, what do you base this on? I'd get, oh, well, this is what's happened in other areas. They couldn't name the other areas. There was never a process of impact or an impact statement done, because I would have liked to have seen the social aspects of an impact statement considered as well, but none of that was done. And we were trying as a council to work through those issues without having any of that detailed information.
Joe Harold remembers there was another possible solution.
And at one stage, it was actually mooted as being heavy vehicle bypass, and that's all, to try and alleviate that issue of, you know, we didn't want the trucks in town, but we certainly still wanted tourists to come by.
An upgrade of the Pacific Highway at Karua was announced in 1996, and polarisation occurred there as it had in Goulburn and Armidale. Traffic Planning Manager at Port Stephens Council, Phil Buchan.
The residents couldn't wait for the cars to be out of town because it made it safer for them, it was quieter, and they didn't have the impacts that the traffic brought. The business people saw it from the other perspective, loss of trade and wouldn't be able to employ local staff. So their perception of the impacts were very, very different.
Bev Manton, coordinator of the Aboriginal Land Council, also remembers a split in reactions to Karua being bypassed.
Prior to the bypass idea taking hold, the general township didn't really know how many people lived in the caravan village, Getty Village, and there's quite a few hundred lived down there, and there are a lot of retirees. They wanted that road gone. They wanted the town to be a sleepy village. Then others were saying, yeah, well, what's going to happen to our future generation? You know, where are the jobs going to come from?
Local historian Gwen Neal has similar recollections.
There were a few in the town that came here in later life and thought, oh, they wanted peace and quiet, but they knew it was a highway town when they came. And I think they really put a big fight up, but they couldn't see for the economy of our town. We just need that highway going through.
Fred McInerney, on the other hand, was exasperated by the traffic.
Yeah, with a license plate, and you'd sit on the corner trying to break into the traffic. I'd drive crazy people that don't want to bypass. You know, look at this, I'm sitting here, I only want to drive down the street and I've got a city for 5 minutes waiting to get around this corner.
Long-time Karua resident and principal property advisor at Port Stephens Council, Cliff Johnson.
I guess the biggest concern that was expressed initially was the actual location of the road. The RTA came up with a study area for the possible routes for the road, and these all involve coming directly through the town or within close proximity to the town, some slightly north and some slightly south of the existing road. And the businesses that saw themselves being dependent on the traffic, such as service stations and small takeaway food outlets, they were really concerned, and they were quite strong in their fight to have the original route of the highway maintained.
Graham Kinnear had an unexpected experience of the strength of feeling against the proposed bypass.
The minister happened to be 50 kilometres up the road, and he was making an announcement to the press and the local community, mainly comprising traders and shopkeepers and petrol station owners, decided that they would get in first. So they had made up a whole range of placards, and they all rolled up in a convoy to where the minister was giving his press statement in Bulladila, and hijacked the minister's announcement. And, of course, they got front-page news.
Armidale businessman Philip Hannah observed the bonding effect that the threat of change had on the community.
Well, a bypass has the effect of creating this mood of uncertainty and somewhat of a fear. And so people will then bond together and say, what are we going to do now? What are we going to do about the bypass? We have to change. We have to take actions that will compensate for our prospective losses.
But would taking action give Armidale residents the result they wanted? University of New England lecturer Angus Witherby had done some research on this question.
Some of my studies had already suggested that bypasses could have both positive and negative effects, but that communities could influence the degree to which those effects worked in the community's favour. Coming out of that, we formed the view that it would be useful to do something proactive. So it really came out of a decision by the council to establish a bypass working party or working group to work through the issues involved with the bypass and try and do things ahead of the steamroller, as we thought of it at the time.
The working party's first decision was to engage with those businesses, motels, fuel and fast food, likely to feel the negative impacts of the bypass. Angus Witherby.
The interesting thing was the different way in which those three sectors addressed the issue. The motel sector was the most proactive. Most of them had already seen the difficulties they were going to have if they were very reliant on passing trade. And so most of them had already started to reorientate themselves as destination motels rather than picking up the itinerant passerby. Fuel basically adopted pretty much a head-in-the-sand attitude. We looked to make provision through planning for the possibility of fuel stops at each end of the bypass, north and south. The principle here was that if the local fuel people felt they were going to get nobbled by the bypass in terms of loss of trade, they'd have an opportunity to either relocate their business or invest in a highway accessible business. As it turned out, none of the local traders took that opportunity. Fast food was probably the area where we anticipated the most difficulty, and certainly the anecdotal evidence was that the McDonald's and KFCs of this world did experience a reasonably solid knock in the early days. probably in the order of 20 to 30% of turnover.
Where Armidale anticipated a downturn, Karua was facing a remake. Formerly a logging town, it had been transformed in late 1963 when the Pacific Highway between Raymond Terrace and Taree was diverted from the Bucketts Way to a newly constructed route closer to the coast. This brought the traffic through Karua and it became a highway service town. Gwen Neal.
Once the bridge was built and the highway went through here, it absolutely made the town, and so many businesses sprang up along the highway. And really, it was a highway town because there were so many eating places and there were three service stations opened in the town and several motels and, of course, the hotel. All that came after the highway was routed through Karua.
If Karua was no longer a highway service town, then businesses might close and services be reduced. This prospect gave rise to concerns about the possible economic and social impacts of the bypass. Phil Buchan.
One of the major things that they saw was if businesses closed down, they'd have to travel greater distances to be able to get some of the services that they'd been able to enjoy at Karua. Even some of the local providers, the baker's shop, also the chemist, because there was no doctor in town. And there were a number of things that were concerning the community about their access to services. With the loss of employment opportunities there for the local people and businesses possibly closing down, the social impact was that the community would be poorer. So the economic aspects really did sit pretty much within business closure. And would there be any new investment in the town? Would there be new businesses that would come and open up?
Community consultation is part of the EIS process. So Graham Kinnear set up a community focus group to discuss the proposed routes for the Karua bypass.
Even though the community may be offside to the site of your proposed road, you have to involve them fully. At our first meetings, people have to vent their spleen, so they stand up and they shout at you and they abuse you and they accuse you of having the outcome all cut and dried and we're going through the charade and you've got all these silver tongues. We don't believe you. And you have to let people get that steam out of the system. And then you start to work with the group. And we say, we think we've discovered a couple of options. We go through town, or there's an option to one side here, an option to another side there. But what are your ideas? What do you think? And through that, after many, many sessions, came trust. Came new ideas. And one of those meetings, the community said, do you know, before the National Parks and Wildlife took over the state forest, we used to go through one of the trails, and way upstream, there's an island called Horse Island. Maybe you could cross up there.
This was a big change in attitude. Cliff Johnson nominates three factors he thinks might explain what was behind it.
The town itself was concerned that a new four-lane highway would actually physically create a barrier and interfere with the community activities and break down relationships between people on various sides of the road. Most of the businesses did see a huge impact coming, but as time went on and they saw the impacts of construction of the road actually in front of their businesses, and the possibility of acquisition, so some of the business buildings may have been interfered with. There was a distinct swing from quite a few of the businesses to support for other proposed routes. And also looking at the percentage of traffic that did not want to stop, all they wanted to do was get through Karua. The businesses realised that the percentage of traffic that did actually want to stop at Karua, particularly in the latter years, was quite small.
Once all the investigations for the EIS have been completed, the information is packaged and distributed for comment. Graham Kinnear.
We put together a thoroughly documented and researched package, and we put that out. We say this is everything we know about the site, from the cost to the impact on the towns and the people and the environment. We think, taking all things into consideration, this is the best proposal we have. Tell us if we've got it wrong.
After the ensuing comments and criticisms have been addressed, the EIS is forwarded to the Minister for Planning for consent to proceed. It was a condition of consent for the Karua Bypass that a committee be set up to develop a social and economic plan for the town. Members of the committee came from the Department of State and Regional Development, the RTA, the Aboriginal Land Council, the Karua Progress Association, business and young people. Phil Buchan was made its coordinator.
So once the committee was established, its job was to work towards the establishment of this plan. The RTA was required to contribute $200,000 towards the plan's development. And the opportunity came about as we started to work with the community through this committee that there were a number of objectives that the community had wanted to get in place as part of the preparation for the bypass and after the bypass. And they were concerned that the $200,000 would be spent on development of a plan without achieving any realistic, I suppose, projects on the ground, etc.
The Department of State and Regional Development's representative on the committee was Ian Mackey.
At that time, I was extremely disappointed with the RTA, with council, with everybody, because it was my opinion that they weren't approaching things the right way. So the department actually left the committee and didn't really take too much notice of what was happening. As far as I'm concerned, everybody underestimated what would happen to Karua way back. They gave them $200,000 to assist them through the bypass and after the bypass, and $200,000 would likely buy them a bench seat in the main street.
The committee determined its objectives, and Phil Buchan's role was to keep them on target.
A number of occasions we actually sat down and talked through what people saw as the future of Karua. So we did our own internal workshops as well, and we utilised opportunities from other council staff to come and talk to the committee, just to ensure that we could provide the fullness of information that was possible, to give the community through that committee an opportunity to know really what was possible in terms of the planning aspects of the town, and also to hear what the aspirations were of the community.
The EIS process assesses every aspect of the project and can have repercussions on design. This was the case with the Karua Bypass. Graham Kinnear.
In this case, we had a very, very sensitive river flanked by wetlands that were protected. In some cases, there were salt marshes, which are now becoming very rare. And salt marshes are very, very important to the ecosystem. They're fish breeding grounds. They are areas where fish can come in and get food. Mangroves go there. They're the lungs of the river system. There was oyster farming in the river. People could get food poisoning if we had polluted the river and the oysters. Now, the project at Karua came at a time when there was a dramatic change in all of the requirements within New South Wales. And you'll find that flora and fauna and archaeology and European heritage and waterways and pollution are intensively controlled.
This sensitive waterway had to be crossed without polluting or damaging it. The solution was both innovative and successful. Graham Kinnear.
We had two bridges. We had a bridge going from the southern side of the river to Horse Island. That's a 200-metre bridge. And then on the other side of Horse Island, going to the northern side of the river, we had a 600-metre bridge. Now, these bridges were very, very cleverly designed. They were designed to be incrementally launched. Incrementally launched meant that they could have a factory at one side and you built a bit, pushed it out, built another bit, and all of the dirty industrial process was kept on the mainland, not near the water, and contained in a very defined factory-type environment.
The discovery of many new heritage items and the preservation of Aboriginal finds, including scarred trees and middens, resulted in a further change to the bridge. Graham Kinnear.
In fact, we extended the bridge by one complete span. Now, to put that in perspective, that's not something we did lightly. On the one hand, there was the legislation. On the other hand, there was the concern by the Aborigines at how important this was. The third issue was that the site was slowly, naturally being eroded and washed away by a bend in the river. And of course, then there was the cost to extend the bridge another span so that it jumped right across this site was six lanes of highway at $2,000 a square metre.
Faced with community concerns that the Armidale bypass would isolate the town from the travelling public, RTA project manager Peter Dutallis decided that a non-adversarial approach was a constructive way to resolve the issue.
We developed a system where we had their issues raised and aired, and we had them on the table and they were incorporated into the design so that we could diffuse the issues or use their resources and their knowledge as part of the project team. To maintain equity in the design where we, the road builders, are more interested in travel savings, we heard what they were saying, and in the intersection designs, we signposted and designed the intersections for equal opportunities to go into the town to visit what the town had to offer, and also another opportunity to go through the bypass route if they were not interested in visiting or staying in the town itself.
Staying engaged with local communities was maintained during the construction of all three bypasses. In Goulburn, project manager Rod Chapman took every opportunity to talk about the bypass.
Any opportunity that was offered to talk about the Goulburn bypass, I took it, such as the Lions Club, Rotary Clubs, Women's View Clubs, church groups. And I probably did two rounds of that during the course of the project. They wanted to know at the start what were the impacts, how it was going to be constructed, when things would happen and how they would happen, and then towards the end, they just wanted to know about completion.
Steve O'Rourke undertook a similar role in Armidale.
We took any opportunity or any invitation to speak to community groups like service clubs, etc. If someone wanted to know something about the bypass, no problems, we'd go up and have a talk to them.
Keeping people informed is good public relations, and it might also avert unforeseen problems. Zone manager at Tamworth RTA, Bob Wood.
It has become standard practice to provide information to the community in terms of brochures and descriptions of what project might be, to hold public meetings, to do whatever else is necessary so that we can take into account community and individual concerns about aspects of a project during its development. So that process has become well established and was in process at Armidale, although it was in the earlier days of its general use. I suppose it covers both public relations in making sure that the public is aware of what's happening and therefore don't jump to the wrong conclusions. And the other one is to actually flush out any particular people or issues that need to be addressed so that they don't become a delay or an embarrassment or something during the course of the project.
Liaising with the community and keeping people informed is a way of managing the perceived threat change poses to people's lives. Peter Dutallis.
The average person in the street doesn't like change, and a town bypass is a change that has potential to impact on them. Now, the more you keep them in the dark about that and the less understanding they have, the more concerned and the more anxious they're going to be about it, and to the point where you get two or three of those anxious people together, then they'll start forming a group based on no understanding. So you have to start feeding them information and getting them involved into the project.
By the time the Karua Bypass was under construction, a variety of options was available to keep the community informed about progress. Graham Kinnear.
RTE issued community newsletters. We had a 1-800 telephone number that allowed people to ring it and be given advice on a whole range of topics. We organised community trips. We provided a pack of information for primary school kids so that they could learn and grow with the project and come and see it on a regular basis and understand how it was all put together. We put together a facility on site which was fitted out with computer, CDs, library, artifacts we'd found. We had displays of history of the area, for example, in photographs. We also set up a website. We kept that updated and we made that site available to the community and, in fact, anyone else worldwide that wished to access it. We had a photo gallery that showed the latest photographs of progress. We had an animation of how the bridge was to be constructed and incrementally launched, that is, pushed out. Another thing is willingness to go beyond what you have to do. And David Bax from Tees, the contracting company that built this project, and myself went out to probably 15 meetings. And you'd take an interest show along to them and tell them about what's going on. You'd get the interest and the enthusiasm up. You'd get the pride in the project and how their area is developing. That's really important to do. It builds a lot of goodwill.
Perhaps the most dramatic way of engaging the community was to get them onto the bridge as it was launched across the Karua River. Dick Whibley.
Because it was a very technical project, particularly the bridge, there was a lot of interest from not only community groups, but also from universities and institution of engineers and all those sorts of groups. So a lot of community involvement, a lot of community inspections. And I guess I can recall taking quite a few tours through the project. Perhaps the most interesting times were when we got community members on the bridge whilst it was being launched. So at certain times during the week, the bridge would be pushed out and we allowed community members at certain stages to actually go and observe that happening, to watch the jacks pushing the bridge out. And part of that was to get them to stand on the bridge whilst it was moving. And they were standing on this huge structure being pushed across the river. Always the interest was when it was going to be completed. When was the traffic going to come out of Karua? When was the school, who had suffered years and years of putting up with trucks going past the school front gate, when was that noise going to stop so they could play in the playground and have lessons in the playground?
In Armidale, the community was encouraged to actively participate in the project. Steve O'Rourke.
We wanted to make the bypass something that the community felt that they had ownership of. We didn't want to say, we're putting a road through your town, hope you like it. We wanted them to feel part of it, and that's why we got them involved in the landscaping. And through local land care / environmental groups such as Greening Australia, which are all coordinated by the council, we organised community groups, including school children, to plant trees.
Especially keen to use the landscaping project as a means of involving the community was Armidale Council's project manager, David Stella.
We actually approached the RTA and asked them if we could look at it as a community planting project and organise local schools and sporting groups to undertake the planting under council's supervision. And they were very keen to do this because it would give a lot of ownership to the project by the community. And that really, I think, galvanised the community into understanding that there was a bypass being constructed and that, yes, it will be a good thing for Armidale and we're involved in it because of the tree planting project.
Construction of the bypass also brought another benefit to Armidale. David Stella.
That was a bit of a fillip for our community here in that we had employment generator because we were going through a fairly flat period. There was a downturn at the university, which was our biggest employer in Armidale.
This fillip to the local economy was also experienced in Goulburn and was a consequence of employing, hiring and purchasing locally. Rod Chapman.
In the heyday, we would have had about 300 people working on the Goulburn bypass concurrently. The contractors employed as many locals as they could. They actually bought their fuel locally. They bought a lot of their supplies, steel reinforcements and other materials from local firms, as much as they could. They also hired local plant and equipment where it was available. It's not necessarily the cheapest way, but they find that in the long term, if they employ locals, they can get the local community on side and leave the local community feeling good. It's a great marketing exercise by most of our contractors, and they still do it now. I'd hate to put a figure on the number of indirect employment that we provided as well. It was certainly a large boost to the Goulburn community and economy for about 3 years during construction.
One of the beneficiaries of this three-year construction period was Goulburn businessman John Guthrie.
All those people that were working on the bypass, initially when they first came to town, they stayed in pubs and motels and commuted to the job. But they realised it was here for the long haul, so after a month in a motel, they rented houses and rented flats and bought fridges and washing machines. Most of the guys I saw in my business were driving F100s and Land Cruisers, and they had a very high disposable income. The blokes in town were earning $300 a week. These blokes were earning $1,300 a week. So they spent what they earned. So the Goulburn economy over that construction period was very, very high.
There were also economic benefits to Karua during the 2.5 years of construction activity. Cliff Johnson.
You couldn't rent a house in the town while the road was being constructed. For example, in our street, there are only six houses, and two of those were occupied by employees of Thies while the road construction was underway.
The RTA encourages contractors to spend locally. Dick Whibley.
One of the plans that we ask the contractors to prepare is their local employment plans for the project, and in that they identify some of the ways that they can spend the money in the community. And I think you find, particularly in Karua, with the number of employees requiring accommodation, all the rentable houses were rented out. I know every time we had to buy meals, we sourced it from the local community. They had a policy of buying from the local hardware store, all those sorts of things. Huge opportunities from the local area. Plant hire, quarries, material supply. So all these jobs offer a lot of spin-offs for the local industry.
Contractors try to fill as many of their employment and material needs as they can from the local area. Resident engineer on the Karua Bypass, Ian Long.
A majority of their general staff and so on, they try to source from as locally as they can. A lot of them are labouring sort of positions. Others were even in the leading hand positions, which were almost foreman-type positions. Clerical staff they get from local sources. All the aggregates came from the nearby Seam Quarry, which is between Raymond Terrace and Karua. Cements or local cements, steel and those sorts of materials were coming from the local suppliers in Newcastle. Most materials were sourced fairly locally.
There were also opportunities for Karua's Aboriginal population. Dick Whibley.
We have an Aboriginal participation requirement in our projects these days, and Karua was one of the first ones where we positively had an Aboriginal participation policy or plan, and the contractor had to look for employment opportunities for the local Aboriginal population and look for opportunities to give them work, whether it be landscaping or physical work or office work, or archaeological work, looking for artefacts on site. We saw quite a few sites officers and Aboriginal members of the Karua Land Council getting those opportunities, but they wouldn't have if the road hadn't been built there.
Aboriginal sites with scarred trees and middens had been identified, and the Aboriginal community became involved in surveying the area for artefacts and places of significance. Bev Manton.
We surveyed all the area. You looked for the places where there could be cultural heritage issues that needed to be preserved, and some places where there's just scatterings of artefacts which were able to be collected at a later date. So all that sort of stuff was all done. Where the bridge actually did go as you travel north on the left-hand side where it reaches the northern side of the river was tool-making camp, and there was all scatterings of slithers of rock, so that was used from there, and so that's still protected. And over the rock areas all underneath where the bridge went to on the other side near Horse Island, then the other places were just near some little wetlands, freshwater springs. We found evidence in those places of artefacts and a couple of stone axes and things like that.
Surveying the area gave the Aboriginal people an opportunity to learn something about their history and to reminisce about the past. Bev Manton.
This current generation, we didn't know about the tool building site that was there. And you can see that's where people would have either carried the canoes to there or made them and had them there and went across the water to Horse Island where all the crabs and that were, because there weren't any crabs on the other side of the river. They were all over here in the mangroves. So that was good. It revisited the history of the Aboriginal people of the area. Sometimes, especially in today's society, you tend to forget a bit about a heritage, the heritage of everyday people. So it was good to talk about all that sort of stuff and revisit, and we produced a small booklet with the RTA on heritage, and that's a good book for the kids for the school.
Giving people a sense of ownership of the bypass and producing something of lasting value were aims of the landscaping project at Armidale. David Stella.
Well, it was really to get acceptance, to feel that the community had some ownership of it, and also that planting trees is also good for the environment. So we used it as an education program as well throughout our community to highlight the value of native trees and native vegetation, because we had gone through 100 years of farming in this area where a lot of vegetation had been cleared, and that a lot of the remnant vegetation was dying because there wasn't enough vegetation, that they had fallen through the environmental critical mass needed to keep the existing vegetation regenerating by itself naturally. It just couldn't do it because there wasn't enough vegetation around. And the RTA were keen to use native plants from this area, and especially of local provenance. And so the Armidale Tree Group was engaged about 5 years before the project kicked off to start collecting seed. And they collected kilograms of seed from various acacias and eucalypts and other shrubs around this Armidale area to be planted along the bypass.
Not everyone wanted native plants, and a debate ensued over the merits of natives versus exotics. Angus Witherby.
What we saw mirrored was the classic warfare that still goes on in this town between those who wish to build upon the European vegetative heritage, which only dates from the 1960s, incidentally. You look at Armidale in the 50s and 40s, and it was bare. There really weren't very many trees at all. It was councils of the day that pushed for the Four Seasons look, as we think of it. And then there are those who say, look, we're in the headwaters of the Macleay River. We've got a World Heritage area just downstream. Would you mind not dropping exotic seed pods in the creek?
Regional Manager of Greening Australia, David Curtis.
There was a school of thought that the climate had changed too much, or the environment had changed too much for the natives to grow because of the dieback problem. And there was other people that wanted the autumn colour of the deciduous imported trees. And sort of that New England kind of thing. So there was a debate, and there was a debate in the press, I think, after the planting. Some people found it too dense. They sort of wanted to be able to have the vistas of the town. Other people wanted the autumn colour. The RTA, I think, rightly decided to plant the nodes around the interchanges with exotic species, the deciduous trees, for colour and sort of impact. But they confined those kinds of plantings to a few ornamentals, and the rest of the route was with natives, which I think was a good plan. I like that landscape approach.
With the decision made, planting got underway. David Stella.
And the way we handled that was we just put a number of ads in the paper calling for people and community groups who were interested in undertaking some plantings along the bypass and to give us
what sort of resources they could get together, and we were prepared to pay them 50 cents a plant in the ground. And we also had a few of the school nurseries propagating some of that seed, and they were paid a dollar per seedling. We probably had over 30 groups, and the groups would turn up with their spades and gloves and undertake the planting during Saturday or Sunday morning, or all day if needs be, depending on how large the plantings were. There would have been hundreds of people involved. I would say that every school, primary or secondary, undertook a planting within the bypass. And, you know, students still come back to me and remember as 7 and 8 year olds doing those plantings at the time, yeah.
Approximately 2,000 school children participated in planting the seedlings. The work was supervised by the Armidale Tree Group, whose manager was Mike O'Keefe.
Once we got the school on site, we would demonstrate for the first 10 or 15 minutes, made sure everybody knew what was going on. And then it was a matter of getting some kind of system so they didn't go higgledy-piggledy everywhere, which was, it was normal total chaos, kids rushing everywhere, stuff everywhere and trees going everywhere. And, you know, there was always grandparents and goodness knows what, they were hanging on sort of thing. And they'd come up and say, how many of these do you think are going to survive? 1%? As it was pretty hair-raising watching them go in, and I would just mutter something and walk away. I mean, it's been absolutely brilliant, of course, that it's been much better than that. I mean, survival rates, we haven't done any survival rates for a while, but in the early days it was around about 85%. It was well over 80, between 80 and 90% survival rate, which was quite extraordinary.
The planting had been successful and the trees and shrubs prospered. David Curtis.
We were trying to establish the indigenous species. So any effort to do major revegetation works, and I always felt it was a major opportunity to re-establish those species that had been lost. And this was a very significant planting because it was so successful. And the trees grew so beautifully. They grew really well. I mean, the flowering up there in springtime was fantastic.
And Mike O'Keefe now had a message he could take to the community.
We had 25,000, whatever it was, trees that we planted with kids this big. Everybody predicted failure. And it was quite a success. I mean, the point that I've tried to hammer home to a lot of people since community groups I get to talk to and so forth, you don't have to get too much right. You've got to get the basics right, and, you know, you've got to get the provenance right, you've got to get the position right, you've got to control weeds, you get the planting timing okay. There's not too much you have to get right. That's it. As far as tree planting is concerned, that's it. From my job's point of view, that was an important message.
The project had been a success from Armidale Council's point of view too. Richard Torbay.
It was more of a community approach than you would perhaps think in the first instance. It was a sort of a symbolic acceptance that you know, the bypass was here and we were going to make it very much part of the community and look at the benefits, and it was very good.
Naming the bridges was another opportunity to involve the Armidale community. David Stella.
The RTA came to us and said, well, you know, there's an opportunity here to name the bridges. How would you like to go about it? So we said, well, let's ask the community if they want to acknowledge someone's community service or someone's of notoriety. So we had a process where people made submissions. A report was put to council based on the submissions made with recommendations in relation to the naming of the bridges, and that was council resolved that this is how we would like as a community to name the bridges, and sent that to the RTA, who basically adopted all the council recommendations.
Seven bridges were named after groups and individuals who had made a significant contribution to Armidale. Joe Harold.
And please, if Neville Wran hears this, he forgives me. But, you know, we could have called it the Neville Wran Bypass Bridge or whatever, but there would have been no local involvement in that, and there would have been no local history. Like most rural towns, Armidale is steeped in its history. It has a lot of pride in its naming of streets and of areas and of events. And I'm sure that that's typical of most places, and certainly it's typical in the country anyway. And this gave us the ability to have some local recognition in there. Armidale also has a long indigenous history in terms of settlement. Armidale was one of those tribal gathering areas at certain seasons, so that needed to be recognised somewhere too.
One of the concerns common to the residents of all three towns was access to the town and the road signage that would attract travellers into them. Steve O'Rourke.
I think we initiated the signs that showed a diagrammatic sign showing the bypass and the town centre and the distances along each leg. So coming up to the intersections, there were big signs saying, if you want to go to the bypass, it'll be 7 kilometres. But if you want, you can go into Armidale, which is 3 kilometres, through Armidale, which is another 4 kilometres, and out the other side. And they could see in advance, I can just circuit through Armidale, it'll only be 1 kilometre more, and join up again.
Signage on the Armidale bypass was another issue that resulted in debate. Richard Torbay.
Signage was an issue because we wanted to also promote the University of New England, and there was a lot of debate about the size, the impact, the visual appearance. And we have a very good senior planner, Steve Gow, who's still with Council, and he had a very good handle on what visual pollution should and shouldn't be. And there was a lot of, you know, a bit of concern about that from some of the business sector who wanted to advertise, given the bypass had gone in. But he managed to work through those issues with them and come up with a good solution.
Armidale businessman Philip Hanna wants something more eye-catching.
There's no welcoming sign. There's no grand entrance. Say, this is Armidale, you should go into it. We've got to put up a very significant signage and entrance. The front window, as we say in the retail trade. What is our front window? Well, native vegetation is never going to be a front window. You've just driven past 300 kilometres of it. No, you've got to create a display. You've got to create an impact, a visual impact, the wow factor, which would include a spectacular display of various trees and gardens and brick and ivy and brass letters are all well lit up. So people would say, driving past there, there must be something in there. There must be something significant.
And there was another project designed to further community acceptance and attract tourists into town. Peter Dutallis.
The bypass was in need of some rest areas, and so we approached the Lions Club and the Rotary Club, I think, at the time, to see if they were interested in supplying furniture and sponsoring rest areas on the bypass route itself. We would supply all the materials, roughly shape and landscape, and they would come in and build it as part of a community project to put up tourist information around there so that people that didn't want to go into the town and stopped at one of the rest areas were able to have a cup of tea, read about Armidale and what the area's attractions are, and then maybe that might indicate to them that they'd go and have another closer look inside town itself.
There were also people in Karua who wanted something special to entice people into their town. Former Karua real estate agent Lynette Payne.
We wanted a really nice entrance, and we wanted something to say that Karua was here and say have a dolphin coming in or something like that. You know, something to beautify the area. But other than having the eat and stay signs, we don't have anything that's really nice to attract people in. Like if you go up the road, Great Lakes Council have put in these huge billboards, you know, the ones you see on the side of the road, and they've actually got pictures of Hawk's Nest Tea Gardens and saying this is what's there so people can see that, and then they know that when they drive in that's what they're going to find. Well, we tried to get one of those too, but we were told it was far too much money, something like $28,000 for it, and we were told no.
The Goulburn Chamber of Commerce survey had also highlighted the need for appropriate signposting. Ken McNally.
And this took some time to happen, but it's in place today, and it's probably the first town to be bypassed which has signage indicating very clearly just how far it is to move off the freeway. And you'll see there today that the distance taken to bypass Goulburn is in fact the same distance to go through Goulburn. And so this was seen as a means of encouraging people to stop because it's on your way. And that was a suggestion that came from the Chamber as a result of this study, and they followed that through and they got their way, and those signs are there today, and I think they're valuable, and I think they've probably also set a precedent for some other communities where the town is still relatively close, to show on the signpost just how close.
The Goulburn Bypass was opened on the 5th of December 1992. How has the city fared in the years since? Group leader on the design team, Fred Moon.
I live in Goulburn. I can see the impact that it's had straight off. I can't believe that the amount of trucks that go around that bypass went down the main street of Goulburn. I walk down that street nearly every day and I think to myself, there's no way in this day and age that could have happened. But it's a much more peaceful, pleasant place to live near than it was then.
Goulburn has now become a city people can use. Local businessman and Deputy Lord Mayor, Steve Swadling.
Main streets, traffic has slowed down with the blisters. It's been beautified with blisters on corners and gardens and mid-block crossings, and it's become very, very user-friendly, and that's exactly what's happening. People are using it. Especially weekends, you find we've become a destination now, not a through traffic route that you have to negotiate, and that's a big thing.
Goulburn's new appeal and its proximity to Sydney are bringing tourists into town. Tourism manager Brian Stokes.
From a tourism perspective, it's given people the ability to stop in town now for a couple of hours rather than just rushing through when they used to be a bit scared of the traffic, there was nowhere to park, people would stop, rush in, get a cup of coffee and take off again. It's now given them an excuse to stop, come down and enjoy Belmore Park. They feel free to have a bit of a wander around town and see what the town's got to offer. And the longer they stay in town, the more they realise that it's actually a sensationally beautiful place, peaceful place. So I think it's been a real boon for tourism, just quietly.
And it's not only tourists who are coming to Goulburn. Katrina Hodgkinson.
I'm finding that as a local member, I'm getting a lot more inquiries from people who are wanting to relocate, particularly senior cits, wanting to come out of the western suburbs and relocate here in Goulburn, where the prices are still affordable, the access is really easy, and they can pick up a house, move to Goulburn, and they've got enough to retire on. So I think that people are recognising just the value of living in country areas and the lifestyle, and of course without the bypass we just wouldn't have that lifestyle.
And if you're not thinking of retiring, Goulburn offers another option. Steve Swadling.
Another point on the lifestyle down here is that you can now buy 100 acres around Goulburn and somebody can have a country lifestyle, and they can go into lavender, goats or alpacas. There's all these different little industries that are popping up. So why not come down to Goulburn, maybe commute back to Sydney, because a lot of people do it, right? Or go back for a couple of days when necessary, but stay down here. That's what people are discovering.
Businesses have undergone change too. Angela Storia.
Another change happening is old businesses are being sold. For instance, Collis's News Agency has changed hands to people from Sydney. The pet shop at the end of the street has changed hands to people from Sydney. I can probably name at least 8 or 9 buildings that have been sold in the last 6 to 8 months. And some of them are quite large buildings and they are being revamped. And Goulburn is getting a facelift generally.
For the first 2 years after the opening of the bypass, Goulburn did experience a downturn. John Guthrie attributes this to the economic boom road construction had brought to the town.
The Goulburn economy over the construction period was very, very high compared to the rest of Australia. So when the bypass opened, the economy, I think, came back to reality, came back to what the rest of the Australian economy was. Nothing to do with trucks not running down the main street. And it changed the type of people coming through to Goulburn. The ones that wanted to go straight through still went straight through on the bypass. Ones that came in now were willing to stop and shop and have a cup of coffee or come to the park or whatever. So even though there was less traffic, there was a higher catchment for the retail area than it was previously, because the ones that did take the effort were willing to take the time.
The businesses that closed in Goulburn tended to be fast food and petrol. And Fred Moon believes the explanation for this lies in the way people prefer to travel.
The fast food and petrol industry has been impacted by the bypass, but more by the development of service areas along the road system, which is what people want to do these days. They don't want to go into a town when they're travelling long distances. They want to get off the road, have their food and get their petrol and then get back on the road again as quick as possible. That's basically the way we live. They don't want to come into towns unless they're looking for tourist attractions or visiting people or whatever. And that's what the towns are for these days, not as service centres on the highway. And that obviously has had an impact, but I don't believe the bypass itself has had the great impact that certain people said it would have.
And what of Goulburn's future prospects? Local businessman and former mayor, Tony Lamara.
I think the city will push ahead because not having so many trucks going through the main street, and bear in mind there was 3,300 every day. So I think it's all been very, very good, and I can see a lot more benefit coming in the future, because what's happening now is because the bypass, the people have been able to get together and promote the city more. Plus, they create events, or most every week you've got a special event for people to come in. All in all, it's been good.
Katrina Hodgkinson also sees a bright future for Goulburn.
I think that bypasses are a very valuable tool that local communities can use to help themselves to grow in the future. And certainly Goulburn, when you look at Goulburn today as compared with what it was like a bit over 10 years ago, there's just no comparison.
The Armidale Bypass opened on the 18th of December 1994, and from an RTA point of view, the results are positive. Bob Wood.
I think the major improvement has been the removal of the heavy vehicle traffic from the old highway route through the residential and commercial area of Armidale. That would have created noise and exhaust pollution and so on day and night. There was also a number of through traffic light vehicles which were removed, which would have reduced the traffic problems in and around the CBD of Armidale at the time. So in terms of providing Armidale and its commercial and residential area with a better environment was certainly successful. But one of the other benefits, of course, of the bypass has been the cutting in time for the through traffic. And, of course, that's one of the principal economic benefits of a road project. And anecdotally, it would seem that we're generally getting about a 15-minute time saving from one side of Armidale to the other than previously was the case.
What changes have Armidale residents noticed? Norm Medhurst.
You feel more safer, and there's no queue-ups of traffic now. And the roundabouts make it a lot better. See, it took 75% of the heavy traffic out of the town.
Matthew Ferris has also noticed improvements.
The CBD is a lot friendlier, and with the East End Mall and the improvements to the West End Mall, the pedestrian amenities definitely improved in Armidale. Certainly notice the lack of cattle trucks dumping their stuff everywhere through town, and being a farming town and a grazing town, there's a lot of cattle trucks that move through town. A couple of the hotels and coffee shops that have opened up on the highway and have alfresco dining, I don't think you would have seen that 11 years ago. It just wouldn't be viable, but they're there now, so that could be a result of the bypass.
Joe Harold agrees.
We did get our town back. I'm sure that there are some people who may wish to give you a differing point of view, but I think from a community perspective and a personal perspective, it was a great thing.
The removal of through traffic has made Armidale more livable, yet the volume of traffic has actually increased. David Stella.
As far as the people living along the old highway, they were very happy about having less heavy traffic travelling through the town, especially at night. And, in fact, the traffic volumes didn't decrease. It's just the growth of Armidale and local traffic, I believe, has contributed to keeping the traffic volumes on the old highway at levels they were prior to the bypass going in. So there's really no argument about passing trade, especially if it's local traffic. They're most likely to use the businesses along the old highway. So that worked out pretty well for most businesses. And there's been no business being able to directly link the bypass to either loss of business or closure of their business in the long term. And I believe most businesses have benefited from having
heavy transports off the old highway and onto the bypass. And I think that the bypass has just been great for Armidale, for our amenity principally, and most people will say that.
There is general agreement about the improvements to Armidale, but what about business? Joe Harold.
I know from a business point of view they were counting numbers from day one. Is this hurting me? Is it hurting me? Is it hurting me?
And there were some negative impacts. Philip Hanna.
Definitely the effect on business was a negative one, but it wasn't major. At the time of the construction of the bypass, I was working in the family department store, and bank card was currently in vogue then, and we were able to decipher our bank cards to determine the location of our customers and the amounts they were spending. So at the time of the bypass, we'd estimated that up to 3% of our bank cards were coming off the highway. We don't have customers from Brisbane, or we don't have customers from, you know, Tweed Heads, or we don't have customers from Newcastle, we don't have customers from Sydney. So we assumed that those customers were passing traffic, highway traffic. When the bypass came into being, that 3% disappeared.
This loss of trade, however, wasn't caused by the disappearance of the truckie. Philip Hanna.
The truckie would never pull up with his giant rig near the main street and waltz up the street and buy a new shirt, or even stop for meals. Truckies have their own haunts, I suppose you could call them roadside truck stops. So the truckie as such was not a customer. He was no loss. Neither his vehicle, his noise, nor his custom were lost. But the mum and dad traveller on their way to Queensland, to the Gold Coast or whatever, yes, there was definitely some loss of custom experience there in these sort of takeaway food shops and in the soft good impulse sector as well. But nothing that would change the balance of a retailer being in business or out of business.
There is another possible explanation for why some businesses experienced a downturn. Richard Torbay.
The factual information that I saw was the average spend for our region had actually gone up, not down, but there was a sharing of that average spend across more outlets because of the impact of the bypass and people keen to build, because the airport was redeveloped on the new highway, and it obviously took some business from the others, but they were just commercial realities in my view. And, of course, when the business sector didn't see the devastation that was, I think, wildly thrown around, then it just became, isn't this a great place to live? And I remember going back to the people who were concerned about the asthma and health and safety issues, and they were just euphoric, was the term, euphoric. The difference in their quality of life was just, you know, almost immeasurable. And I remember thinking, gee, this was the right decision.
The Karooa Bypass was opened on the 22nd of September 2004, and Fred McInerney's frustration with the traffic was now a thing of the past.
I remember the first day the bypass opened, I was up north somewhere, and I come back with a trailer on the car, and I needed some beer from the bottle shop over here. And coming in and planning where I'd park on this side of the street and walk across, and I sort of looked up the street and looked in the mirror and said, I can do a U-turn. And it was sort of unheard of, you know, unthought of. And I come out of the bottle shop with my carton. I put it in the car, and again, I was sort of planning, you know, I'll dash across here and I'll turn right at the lights. And I got in the car again and looked up the highway and looked in the mirror and thought, I can do another U-turn. This is unbelievable.
Most people agree that Karooa is a better place to live in than it was prior to the bypass. Lynette Payne.
To live here now is much better. Before, we used to have something like 30 to 50,000 cars at Christmas time go through. And Karooa's not a terribly big area. So we had all that traffic and traffic fumes and that. And the air quality wasn't crash hot. But now, with it gone, yes, it's a beautiful little place to live. But the impact on the business has been absolutely dreadful.
Karooa's economy had been based on highway traffic, and now that traffic was gone. Ian Mackey.
A lot of people have argued to me that Karooa's better off because they own 30,000 cars coming through the main street. I totally agree with them. Any town would be. But then you look at what Karooa was doing the day before the bypass and what Karooa was doing after the bypass. Karooa has been massively, massively affected socially, culturally and economically. And if two other businesses close, look like closing in the main street, it will kill the town. That's how on edge this place is.
Some businesses closed and others struggled on. Manager of Karua's one surviving service station, Sharon Mooney.
There were another two service stations in the town. They closed. There have been other businesses closed since the bypass because they relied on the highway traffic. All businesses in Karua that have food rely on highway traffic.
80% of Mobil's trade was lost, and with it 24 of 40 jobs. Sharon Mooney.
It was a massive loss. We will never, ever get that back again.
Accommodation was also badly affected. Owner of Karua Motor Inn, Wayne Keft.
Pre-bypass, we had an occupancy rate of around 65%. Now we're down to 43%. It's just borderline. Our biggest trade loss is the people that come into a town, see the motel open, oh, we're tired, we'll stay here. We just don't get that type of trade anymore, and that's where we've lost most of our trade.
Karua had known for years that the bypass was coming. Had anyone tried to be proactive? Sharon Mooney.
For 12 months previous, we've formed a Chamber of Commerce and we put up banners to say, you know, after the bypass, don't bypass Karua. The council paid for those. The Mobil itself, I changed the menus, and I think changing the menu helped a lot because before we were kind of fast food and then we became home-cooked meal. You know, for 12 months there was a lot of changes made in the business to counterbalance the bypass. It has worked. We get a lot of elderly people coming in to have their nice home-cooked meal. And I suppose in a lot of ways it's surprising how many people do come off the highway to visit us.
Cliff Johnson has also noticed small signs of improvement.
The percentage of traffic that comes off the highway now compared to the total number of traffic on the highway is very, very small, but the actual numbers of vehicles that are stopping is starting to climb up quite a bit.
And things are improving for some of the town's businesses. Cliff Johnson.
Well, there are two shops there now, the butcher shop and the hot bread shop, that were talking of closing as soon as the highway went in, and they didn't. And now they're quite happy that they didn't.
Adapting to the new circumstances seems to have been the answer. Bev Manton.
The fact remains that you have to diversify. There's a few businesses did that and are still surviving, going quite well. And we've got a couple more new businesses come to town. And we've got a computer shop. We didn't ever have anything like that in the town before, and it's great just having that there.
And Wayne Keft thinks the worst might be over for his motel.
It sort of bottomed out around Christmas of last year, and it seems to be holding steady to what we would expect now. Don't see a great increase in trade except for the normal increases in people that are travelling and that, but it will be a very slow process to climb back up the ladder again. We can struggle on the way we are, and I've gone and got a job driving a bus, school bus morning and evening, just to give us a little bit extra cash.
Karua's chances of recovery depend on the efforts of groups like the Working Together Committee, chaired by Town Coordinator Ian Mackey.
We've done branding, we've done some marketing, we've done a website, we've done some brochures. We want to do some training with businesses on how they can market and work together. We want to get the businesses together, specifically the five accommodation places, and look at target markets and spend some of the Karua Working Together money to help them help themselves and set up programs that attract customers to the place. You've got to go out and get them. You can't wait for the customers to come here.
There is no shortage of ideas when it comes to what can be done for Karua. Wayne Keft.
Probably one of the simplest things, and this is what our customers are telling us, that we need some signage up on the highway, which seems to be impossible for us to afford and even to get the shires to allow us to put up. A lot come in and say, oh, we're a bit surprised that the motels are still here. We weren't really sure. We just come in on the odd chance that you might be open.
Signage would also let travellers know that Karua is the northern gate to Port Stephens. Lynette Payne.
A lot of people used to pull up to my real estate office and say, like, how do I get to Port Stephens? And I used to say to them, you're in Port Stephens. Karua is the north gate to Port Stephens. And we used to say to Port Stephens Council, as far as we're concerned, Karua should have been like a little showcase town because you were coming into Port Stephens from the north. And when you got to Karua, there was virtually nothing. And yet you go over to Nelson's Bay, the money seems to have been spent all in that area. And if we'd have got just one-tenth of it, Karua would have been better off. And we would have had a nice little attractive town for people to come and stop in.
But Karua is not without assets. Bev Manton.
We have this most beautiful resource that flows past our doors. Karua River is one of the few rivers that you can catch fish in these days. A lot of the other places are just fished out and trawled out. But Karua, you can still go there and get a feed of fish. It is the most magnificent river.
Wayne Keft agrees.
I suppose our biggest asset is that river. And a really good boat ramp would bring people in to use it more. I don't know if that would actually get people in our business to stay, but at least people would be coming in, spending money, at the other shops and things around. And also promote that we're not so far. I mean, we're 15 minutes to the beach at Hawk's Nest, and people go over the other side and drive longer than that to get to the beach from Salamander or whatever.
It would seem to be just a question of money to build a boat ramp, improve the township's appearance, promote its attractions. But there are limits to what can be done. Phil Buchan.
There's been a lot of interest in terms of Karua being a retirement location. People have said it's a nice place, quiet, to retire. And I guess there are a number of environmental aspects, physical aspects of the town and its environment around it that make it attractive in that sense. I guess the only thing is the lacking some of the support services that you might require, particularly as a retiree, but even new families. But Karua has some opportunities there, and it only seems to be restricted by Hunter Waters' cap that they've put on the number of residential properties that can be sewered. Being a sensitive environment in terms of an oyster growing area, obviously you don't want contamination of the estuarine area to impact on that that industry. So it is being carefully managed.
One of the biggest issues affecting Karua is that it's a small town. Lynette Payne.
If Karua had been the size of Raymond Terrace or Goulburn, we would have had a foot in the door. But Karua's not very big. We've only got a population of around about 12 to 1400. And there's not enough population here at the moment to sustain the businesses. Most of the people don't spend their money in town as far as shopping because we don't have a shopping centre as such. We've got the little general store where the news agency is, but most of them have to go to Raymond Terrace or up to Tea Gardens to Bylow.
The size of Raymond Terrace means it has more to offer. Bev Manton.
Raymond Terrace has boosted the corporate side of the township. There are more businesses in there now, larger shopping centres with lots of specialty shops. And the roads improved so much so a trip to Raymond Terrace is not as hard as it was a long time ago. So it's much easier now. So you're into Raymond Terrace in 15 to 20 minutes.
But Raymond Terrace isn't everyone's first choice. Gwen Neal.
A lot of people do go into Raymond Terrace to do their shopping, but there's a lot of old people that haven't got cars and things to go into Raymond Terrace. So we want a nice shopping centre. The shops that are here now, they do their best. The paper shop's a very good shop and, you can do banking here and everything, so that's convenient. We should think enough of our town to spend some of our money here.
There are hurdles, but there are also plans and aspirations. Bev Manton.
Our people were great boat builders. They built ocean-going yachts, racing yachts. So I started this project 18 months ago. We started building all these boats. We've got 5 boats built up there that you could row them or put a sail on them or have a small motor on the back. And we were going to have guided river tours, Aboriginal guided tours. But in any case, I'm a bit of a romantic and I just wanted people to get back on the river again.
Wayne Keft is working on 2 sports packages.
We are trying to promote some golf packages. We are getting a few bowlers coming in, so that type of thing could be worth, well, it is worth working on. It's just a matter of getting people interested in coming to Karua for a bowls day and a golf day.
Sharon Mooney knows of a small town where one business has made all the difference.
I know there's a place down near Albury and the bakery, built a bakery shop, and they get
busloads of people going to this bakery shop. They get busloads of people. And there's nothing else in town. We need a businessman. We need somebody in a business with money to start, to say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pour all this money in, and this is going to be a showcase. It won't take much, but it has to take something.
A summary of this oral history would risk trivialisation. However, it can be said that the bypasses of Goulburn, Armidale and Karooa have served the travelling public and the overall economy well by reducing travel times and costs. The benefits to the towns have been reduced noise, pollution and congestion, and improved safety and amenity. A consistent theme that can be drawn from the interviews conducted for this project is that of change. Towns change gradually as highway traffic levels grow to the point where planning for a bypass is warranted. They change again during the period that a bypass is being constructed, and they change it again after the bypass is opened. The ways in which agencies and local communities anticipate and acknowledge these changes, plan for their consequences, and then adapt to the various changes will determine the overall local impact of the bypass. Where Goulburn and Armidale have been able to take advantage of their new circumstances, Karooa, for reasons particular to its location and its size, is still going through a period of adjustment.
When it comes to social and community benefits, we feel that the community is benefiting from highway upgrades because we have safer and better travelling conditions.
Certainly the number of semi-trailers and things like that that it removes from the main street makes it a lot friendlier, a lot easier to shop.
I remember thinking, gee, this was the right decision.
At the end of the day, it's probably done us a little bit of good and probably hasn't done us too much damage. We're probably better off with it than without it, but we certainly haven't used it as a catalyst in the way that it could have been.
I think that bypasses are a very valuable tool that local communities can use to help themselves to grow.
We want to get the businesses together and set up programs that attract customers to the place. You've got to go out and get them. You can't wait for the customers to come here.
I just want to give credit to the RTA. I think they've done a pretty marvellous job, because to negotiate with a township on bypassing the town is not an easy task.
The RTA would like to thank all those who contributed to this project, and in particular recognises the contribution of Rod Chapman and Mike O'Keefe, who sadly passed away while the oral history was in preparation. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. This oral history records the personal experiences of people involved in or affected by the construction of a town bypass. More information on town bypass effects can be found in two recent RTA studies. The first, titled Evaluation of the Economic Impacts of Bypass Roads on Country Towns, was undertaken in 1996 by the University of New South Wales. It examines the impacts of the highway bypasses at Goulburn, Yass, Gunning, Mittagong and Berrima. The second study deals with the economic and social impacts of the Karooa bypass and was undertaken by the University of Sydney 1 year after the opening of the bypass. This study was a condition of approval for the project and will be replicated 5 years after the opening of the bypass. Both studies are available from the RTA Library in Parramatta.